the objectives of my presentation are to discuss the problem, describe the environmental scan method, list lessons learned with supporting evidence, and make recommendations. I just want to note that this is a pilot study and was funded by the NICHD. As we all know by now, overweight and obesity is rapidly increasing within the United States, and it disproportionately affects low-income minority groups, and especially children, and the associated factors are the environment in which they reside, their ability to participate in physical activity, and their nutritional habits. And this issue is being addressed through policies at the federal, state, and local level, and there are some examples of the types of policies that exist. So, why is it important to address this issue? It's the economic cost to the United States. The CDC noted that in 2000, obesity cost the United States economy roughly $117 billion. That's indirectly and directly. And in Maryland alone, it cost us $1,553 million in 2004. So my research question is, how can physical activity and nutrition policies be used to inform program planning to address obesity reduction in a low-income minority and urban community? And my conceptual model is a socio-ecological model. Basically, whatever is provided from the policy level, which is the macro level, will trickle down to the individual. If resources are made available through policy, the community will be able to access these resources and form organizational structures. If there are organizational structures making a difference, individuals within the community will become aware of them and access these resources. So my study objectives are to determine the existence of policies targeting physical activity and overweight and obesity. Also to obtain data on awareness of these policies, as well as obtain data on communities' members' willingness to advocate for these policies and make recommendations to address the gaps in public policies. The methodology used is the environmental scan. The environmental scan can be used as a need assessment tool, and it's for my study, it was broken up into three parts, and the first part was the document review. Basically, what I did, I went online, I used Google Scholar, PubMed, searched government websites, went to the library, looked for documents, anything that gave me information on initiatives being taken by any level of government to address overweight and obesity through physical activity and nutrition. Part two involved me conducting in-depth interviews. In-depth interviews were conducted with key stakeholders or who had an invested interest in the community. As you can see, I conducted interviews with two program directors, a community advocate that advocated for children's rights, and two state health department employees who worked on the Maryland Physical Activity and Nutrition Plan. The interviews were taped and transcribed, which was later used for data analysis. Part three involved us conducting social meetings with members of the community. These weren't actually planned. What happened was we heard of any community events going on. We attended those events. We spoke to community members and we asked them preset questions ranging from, do you believe obesity and overweight is a problem in your community? Are you willing to advocate for change? And what could we do as researchers and policy planners to address the issue? So we also conducted neighborhood scans. Neighborhood scans involved us walking around or driving around, taking pictures of the community. We took pictures of fast food outlets, liquor stores, recreational facilities, churches, and schools. The policy piece was just one part of the project. The project also consisted of us looking at the potential role of churches, schools, and food establishments in addressing the issue. The sampling method used was a snowballing method. Basically, we had a partner, community-based organization partner, who gave us contacts who they worked with in the community. We met these individuals, and they gave us further contacts who could help us obtain information about what we could do within the community. And the analysis that we conducted was a simple coding method. The simple coding method, for the in-depth interviews that we transcribed, we went through line by line and coded each sentence that was relevant to the questions that we asked. We also coded the pictures that we took and any observations we made during the neighborhood scan. And it was categorized, and the general themes that came out of these categories were what we determined needed to be setting, the study setting, the population was generally African American, but 25% white, 1.1% Asian, 1.2% Hispanic, and roughly 2% of other races. From a previous study done within the community, we realized that 53% of men, 62% of women within the community were overweight or obese. And the community was low income. The median income was $23,070 per annum compared to the median income of Baltimore, which was $30,000. And 52% of the community earned less than $25,000 per annum. So, lessons learned. What we found out that the community was generally unaware of health initiatives being taken within their community, and this is expected in a low-income community which generally has a low educational level, which hampers their awareness of government initiatives within their community. I also spoke with a director of a literacy program within the community, and he wanted us to understand that not everyone reads at the same level, and most of the community receives their information via the radio or television. So we as program planners or developers and policymakers need to be aware that we can't only just develop flyers and brochures and newsletters and expect the community to be aware of what's going on and what they need to change in their behavior to address the issue. Also, community's perception also played a part in the prevalence of overweight and obesity. And as you can see, the community advocate noted that sometimes the individuals equated being of a larger size with doing well. If you're financially secure enough to eat well, it shows in your body size, basically what he was trying to say. So culture is very important. It needs to be incorporated into any programmatic intervention that we develop in a low-income and minority community. Access to preventive health care and healthy foods. Most of the individuals in this community would have no health care insurance, so their only access to health care would be through the ER. That would be their first point of access to health care. And we know that, of course, most of the food outlets available in the community are fast food outlets, usually selling fried chicken wings and lake trout and burgers, all that good stuff. So another lesson learned was the fact that there's limited funding for physical activity and nutritional programs within the community. And from my research, I discovered that the CDC does provide funding for nutritional and educational programs within communities. However, they provide only $37 million in 2006 for 28 states. And this funding is not sustainable. It's projected to end in 2008. So if we want the community to continue with the programs we develop, we need to develop sustained funding opportunities for them to continue with the intervention. So the major lesson learned, of course, was that poverty played the biggest influence on a person's ability to address their weight. And because the community is low income, of course, there's high crime. And because there's high crime, individuals don't feel safe enough to go out and actually take part in any physical activity in the facilities that are available. For instance, walking along their sidewalk may prove hazardous to them, or even you going to the park. And also, you know, because it's poor, most large supermarket chains won't feel comfortable, you know, bringing their business there because they're afraid that they're going to be victims of crime at a higher rate than anywhere else. So here's a picture of the community that we worked in. As you can see, there are empty lots, streets are dirty, derelict homes, boarded up houses, and boarded up houses means drug pushers actually living there, and all other sorts of bad elements. And most people wouldn't want their children being outside just for the mere fact that they're afraid that they're going to be, you know, tried to be recruited into a gang, or drugs are going to be tried to sell to them. Here is a playground that's located in the community, and as you can see, it's empty. And this was taken during the summer vacation during the day, and there's no children there, not one. So it just goes to show that one of the reasons that they may not be there is because of safety issues. another lesson learned was that policies do exist in the community, and they do address some of the community's concerns. However, they do not specifically address cultural factors, poverty, and health literacy. As well, the community does believe that overweight and obesity is a problem, and they are willing to advocate for increased physical activity and nutritional and proper nutritional habits in their community. So my recommendations are, we need to advertise the initiatives that are being, or the resources that are being offered to the community. If we expect them to actually be to sustain any programs we develop, they must be aware of the resources that are available to them. Also, we need to involve the community in the policy process. This means having them go to the state legislators and lobbying for them to change laws. For instance, Maryland only allows 1 credit hour a year for physical activity. I think that should probably be increased to 1 credit per semester, not just 1 year. Also, we need to ensure that there's an increase in funding for our programs, so that not just an increase in funding, but again, sustained funding, so that we can not only incorporate and address health issues, but address other social and economic issues that the community faces. And if we address the environmental and social issues that the community faces, people wouldn't only have to wake up and think about how I'm going to pay my bills, or how am I going to feed my children, or how am I going to clothe myself. When they have to focus on those things, it's more likely they're going to focus on their health. So we need to, as researchers, find a way to reduce those barriers so that they would change their behavior. So in conclusion, physical activity and nutrition policies in low-income minority and urban settings can be more effective if specific characteristics of the community, such as health, literacy, poverty, and cultural values, are considered. And if these things are considered, it will empower the community and allow them to focus on their health instead of the day-to-day life challenges. Thank you.
That's very interesting. And I neglected to read Kyle's bio, which I should have at the start, because he is a recent graduate of Morgan State University School of Community Health and Policy. He just graduated in May of 2007. So, great research project. And he is currently working in the healthcare field and as a research associate with the Morgan State University Maryland Pesticide Network Integrated Pest Management and Healthcare Facilities Community Outreach Project. And that was too long. But for all of you that are employers out there, his career goal is to address access to quality healthcare among disadvantaged groups and advocate for social justice. So it's a great presentation. Our next speaker. That's okay. Our next speaker, there is a slight change in the program. Latarsha Wadi was not able to be here today, and unfortunately she wasn't able to load her presentation. But we have a stand-in, Stacy Plikta. Dr. Stacy Plikta will just talk about this program, Diabetes Self-Care Activities in a Public Health Population.
Good afternoon, and I'd like to apologize to you all for us not having the slides here, but I didn't want you to go away without hearing anything about Latarsha's project. She was one of my master's students, and this was her master's practicum project. And she's also a public health nurse who works with chronically ill populations in a place called Hampton, Virginia, which isn't too far from here, a couple of hours, and it's a fairly urban, fairly poor area. And she noticed that a lot of her patients were coming into the free clinic with diabetes and not really, you know, she had the impression they weren't doing what they were supposed to be doing, that they weren't necessarily taking their medication the way they should, they weren't necessarily doing the other self-care activities. And I said to her, you know, impressions really aren't enough. Why don't, you know, you find some systematic way of finding out what is it that they're doing and what is it that they're not doing. And as you all know, adequate diabetes management can reduce morbidity and mortality because the key to it is proper blood glucose control. And without proper blood glucose control, people can suffer all sorts of complications from diabetes, including neuropathy, loss of limbs, cardiac events, and you know, wounds that won't heal, all of which she sees in her clinic. So the objective of her study was to explore the extent of diabetes self-care activities performed by the adult population that was coming to her public health clinic. And what she did, the clinic was new to research and a little hesitant, and this is one of the challenges of real-life research, so she couldn't telephone people directly and ask for consent. So she first had to mail out postcards to all of the patients who'd been seen for diabetes in the past year, and only those folks who'd mailed cards back, those were the only folks she was allowed to call. And so her response rate's fairly low because some folks simply don't have phones. Folks who are clients of public health clinics tend to move around a bit. Not greatly, but might move from city to city. And so when you move from city to city, you move from one public health clinic to another. But she was able to do interviews with 48 people with diabetes who'd been treated at her clinic in the past year, which was 23% of the total diabetic population of that clinic. And the group was reflective of the folks that go to that public health clinic. 85% were African American, 88% were female, about 68% were obese. The great majority, 89%, had type 2 diabetes. And these were middle-aged folks. The average age was 58. And we were surprised that it was only 42% that had no form of health insurance. But we also have a lot of veterans, a lot of veteran dependents, and so some folks had some access to other care that way. She used a questionnaire based on the summary of diabetes self-care activities, which assesses self-care activities in the past week. And she chose that because of recall, because it's very hard for folks to accurately remember, did you check your feet every week for the past year? You know, it's a hard thing for people to report accurately. But most folks can tell you what they did in the past week. And so that was the scale she chose. And we added some questions about health status, insurance, barriers to care, other comorbidities like high blood pressure, which was the primary comorbidity. And what she found was that most respondents had multiple diabetic complications, that people had neuropathy, people had eye trouble, people had issues with wound healing. That adherence to medication was really high, and this was, I think, a positive surprise because that was not the impression as a nurse she'd gotten. But all the insulin users and the oral and 92% of the oral medication users reported taking their medication as prescribed, and this is self-report. But the adherence rates were much lower for diet. Only 43% adhered to the type of diet you'd expect someone with diabetes to adhere to. Only 46% reported getting any exercise in the past week. Only 40% said they tested their blood sugar at least daily. And only 50% engaged in the type of foot care that diabetics should engage in, checking their feet daily, immediately noting any problems, getting their foot checked by a physician at least once every few months. And the barriers to adherence, I think, were really similar to the barriers that the other presenters have talked about. The cost of food was a big issue. People said they couldn't eat right because if you're on a limited income, fresh produce is both a lot more expensive and it goes bad. You know, Doritos don't go bad. You can keep a bag for 2 weeks. You know, grapes go bad. Apples go bad. So it was the cost of testing supplies. If you ever tried to price diabetic supplies, you can get the meters for most pharmacies, you can get the meters for close to free, but it's the testing strips are really expensive. And for folks who aren't on Medicaid or any kind of insurance, they just can't afford them. Lack of motivation. Some people said they just didn't feel like exercising. They were tired. They wasn't of interest to them. Having other medical conditions that interfered with being able to exercise and not being able to manage those, folks with heart conditions or who are hypertensive, those were the two, I think, biggest ones. And really the conclusion she came to is that we need interventions that educate, and not just educate, but that motivate diabetics and that help them to engage in the kind of self-care, changes in diet, increases in exercise, that we can, and also that we need to have some policy changes. Right now her clinic cannot supply testing supplies. It's a public health clinic. If they could supply testing supplies, more people would test their blood sugar. So there needs to be some policy changes and really some ways developed to assist people with diabetes in better managing their care.
Thank you very much for presenting her findings. Difficult to get out spontaneously like that. We do appreciate not having a gap in the program. So.
little ahead of schedule, and I'm a little loath to move on. I'm sorry, because I worry about people that want to go back and forth between different programs, and I would hate for anybody that came in to see Jeff's program at 3:30 and he'd already started. So why don't we go ahead and take questions right now, if anybody has any questions for any of our previous presenters. Does anybody? I saw your hand first, so... they do have a process of looking for geographical diversity as well as community diversity. There are some criteria that it's being used to evaluate these type of applications. So it is being documented, the diversity of the community. But it would change from community to community. Some are very rural. For example, if you looked at the cohort that's being funded currently, Chesterfield, South Carolina is a very rural community. And then you could look at, in that same cohort, we have New York being funded. So again, we're looking for diversity both of geography, urban, suburban, rural, as well as communities of diversity. This is not, a SIP is usually for a PRC, a Prevention Research Center. The comment was that many times where you're looking at communities where there may be low income or poverty, looking at the funding opportunities and the amount of money that can actually be used by those communities. And this is not a Prevention Research Center, is usually because you brought it up as a SIP, and that. Well, keep in mind, again, this is the local Y chapters are the ones that develop their own applications. The amount of money that actually goes to a YMCA, it's one-time funding. This is not funding sent to a YMCA year after year after year. It is one-time funding that's sent to a local Y community, and there's an internal coach within the local YMCA and an external coach, which is a community member. And then again, keep in mind, too, they have eight other community members that are part of that community action team. The amount of funding that actually goes to a PHC, a Pioneering Healthy Community, is between $37,000 and $70,000 for 1 year. And the reason why I think that's important to emphasize is that we're not talking about a development of another program. We're talking about looking how to extend, again, within that multi-level approach where programs are already occurring, to change the environment, change the policies that would create the sustainability around the programs that are already being implemented. But YMCAs do a great job of programs, and again, if you look at the communities, many times there are other CBOs who are doing obesity prevention, cardiovascular initiatives. So, again, this provides an opportunity for these different initiatives to come together as one community action team, and that's why I think there's a really important emphasis around consensus building and making sure that the Y views itself as just a convener and not the leader of the group, because it really is about coalition building.
You had a question?
Well, she actually answered my question.
Okay.
Measures,
the emphasis has been, the evaluation is focused on the communities themselves. So, for example, we have 13 communities in the first cohort, 20 in the second, 13 in the third, and now 18 in the fourth. So the responsibility has been based off the community and the engagement of those members. However, and that's really because the money that has been funded for Pioneer Healthy Communities has gone directly to the communities. CDC as an agency has not kept the money in-house. Therefore, we're working right now with YUSA, though, to look at a programmatic or systematic view of across the different initiatives, how to be able to evaluate that. And we have discussions right now with a university to assist with that, with YUSA.
Will they get additional funding to be able to do that? Because I know that that's oftentimes the, you know, when an initial grant goes out to build a coalition, and then that fund, you said, it was a one-year funding, and then the Trump funds
will the local community receive
money?
No. No, because the money will go to YUSA, and so it'll be up to YUSA to determine, right, the evaluation procedures that then can be used by the community. Yes.
I'm sorry, we're right at, okay. Rob, can you make it a fast question?
You were asking me if I asked specifically if their healthcare provider spoke to them about overweight and obesity. No, we didn't ask them about different medical providers. Basically, we just asked them if they were aware of the issue of overweight and obesity and if they felt that that was a problem in their community. And in relation to the photos, you were asking how we categorize the photos. If we basically took photos of fast food outlets and everything else, and if it felt under physical activity, the pictures of the recreational areas went there. If it fell under food outlets, it went there. If it fell under churches, it went there. If it fell under policy, well, everything else, basically all the pictures fell under policy because policy was so broad. So basically that's how we categorize the pictures. Well, we categorize, and basically from the pictures and our observations and the meetings, we came up with the general idea of what the community thought we could do to assist them.
Is Jeff Swartz, who is a public health advisor in the National Cancer Institute's Office of Communications and Education.